Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 70, where Pedro, Leonardo, Tom, and our special guest Samantha Ortiz are discussing Eduardo Ibarra Collado's work, Organization Studies and Epistemic Coloniality in Latin America, Thinking Otherness in the Margins, published in the journal Organization back in 2006. In part two, we shift our discussion to the present day. To what extent does Ibarra Collado's critique still hold true? If you missed part one, you can access it on our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So we have been talking about the text Organization Studies and Epistemic Coloniality in Latin America by Eduardo Ibarra Collado. And this is a text which is an introduction to a special issue that featured, I think, 5-6 papers, some empirical, some theoretical, with exactly cases and discussions about the kind of research that Ibarra Collado is trying to promote and has promoted throughout his career, right? He was very active in EGOS, APROS, and also in LAEMOS. And in this very paper, the structure that goes, we talked about that in the first part, you know, it's very much a manifesto, and it's about trying to explain what are the issues that exist, you know, what he calls epistemic coloniality, and the way that there is a tendency towards falsification, so just taking the theories from the center, as he called it, or we can say the global north, and try to apply and, or even force them to the context of Latin America. And then he talks about what is important to build from a position of coloniality in a positive way and try to understand this very social, political, economic context and the particular way of organizing that emerges and particular set of challenges that exists in this part of the world. And then he offers a research agenda with three very broad kind of almost principles, right? He talks about what has modernity meant for Latin America in terms of organizational problems. He asks what are main social organizational problems of concern in Latin America. And he also questions how should we interpret labor issues and so-called postmodern forms of organization in this region. And in all this, he talks about how neoliberalism and all types of political economy forces have prevented the recognitions of indigenous ways of organizing, of alternatives to the kind of more liberal, neoliberal agenda and way in which has framed the debate. Leonardo talked about, you know, the modernization theory through which was very central in understanding the condition of Latin America and how we should go beyond that and try to overcome such a stage. But I think that in this proposal for future research, a lot of that is still at a high level, right? Because I think Eduardo Ibarra Collado is trying to elbow and create this space and showcase the importance of the work in itself and how we should go about trying to understand organization phenomena differently in this context and in other contexts as well around the other peripheries of the world. But it doesn't necessarily get at what we would discover or how we should orient our attention, what are particularly the kind of issues that have been misconstrued or misunderstood because we operated into a particular mindset. You know, so I thought that maybe in this part, we could try to elaborate a little more of that and look forward on what has been done in the past, you know, 14 years since the paper has been published and what, you know, where the going forward lies.
Yeah, so I think I agree with you, Pedro, that he leaves it that this article is mostly about creating a space and that a lot of the critiques or recommendations that he makes are very broad, and it's kind of, it was left up to us to interpret that and to look for the kinds of studies that are doing what Ibarra Collado was proposing. I think what I would have expected to see, let's say that that what he's proposing in this article is a sort of an intellectual project that is common to all of Latin America. And so what I would have expected to see is a boom of more empirical studies that are being published both in local and international journals that are looking at phenomena that is very particular to some of Latin American countries, maybe proposing some theories, some new theories, some new concepts in which we can talk about that, and then eventually engaging in some comparative studies across Latin America. And I think what we see now, or more than what we see, I think it's difficult to see what there is now because of many things that he already points out in this article and that I think continue to be true. So the fact that a lot of this research gets published in local journals in Spanish or in Portuguese, and that are journals that are published not very periodically, right? But it's kind of, and a lot of this is unknown also across countries. So, I mean, another thing, I mean, obviously the big question is if there is such a thing as Latin American organization studies. And I think there's two dimensions to this question. One dimension or one problem that we can discuss is what is labeled as organization studies from the work that gets done here, because I think in Latin America, a lot of the work that could fit under organization studies also is very close to sociology, public policy, public administration in particular. So you know, to kind of discuss what we mean by organization studies in the region. And then also if there is such a thing as a Latin American project, a shared project. What I see when I try to look for what's happening in Latin America is just a series of small local networks, programs located in certain institutions, but it's all very local and it's very country level. And I think that there isn't such a strong flow of ideas and theories across countries in Latin America.
So let me ask this. Do we think that what the author is talking about and what we think would make the most sense is to really focus heavily on strengthening the local networks? You mentioned the Latin America project. I hope I heard that right. Maybe using less formal tools like public scholarship or other things in order to expand the network so that at least within the local context, you know, this research agenda is being followed, and sort of, step aside from worrying about what the center thinks, for example, and, you know, let's get it right internally first before, or find different venues or different ways of getting the voices heard outside.
I think so. I think that could be a way. The kind of problem that jumps to me when I hear you say that, which of course would be will be ideal to kind of turn inside and work on these networks and these journals or publications, is that most universities in Latin America are subject to the same rules than international schools, right? So professors are forced or expected to publish in top journals in English, do all this kind of work. So I think that, I mean, I think a first challenge that I would identify is how we can build a local network and local spaces under this condition.
So guess what? The first challenge and possibility is organizational, right? Meaning that there is something about being able to connect researchers and being able to, because we know the infrastructure of what is called in epistemic coloniality has a deep infrastructure, meaning that the people are socialized in a particular way with certain values, with certain ties, with certain models, right? And the first challenge is to able to literally create the infrastructure that is south-south, not just, you know, south-north, north-south, and so on and so forth. So that goes into terms of what kind of spaces are there for people to connect, what kind of research funding there is for south-south connections, what kind of problems that are considered relevant are there that are considered relevant for that context. Because I'm saying all these things because a lot of research bodies, international research bodies, want to promote the connection of all kinds of African and Latin American particular researchers or schools with Northern institutions and research that brings these two together, not necessarily connecting institutions in the South together, right? Or the kind of problems that, you know, as Leonardo was saying in the first part, all this whole agenda of modernization, which was connected with the UN and all types of foundations that have been created to promote the socioeconomic advancement, and advancement in with air quotes, please, of Latin America, which meant trying to bring ideas and issues and trying to measure, understand, examine under that sort of conditions from the north what is happening in the south, instead of trying to see, well, what can the different countries that have the similar heritage learn from each other? So that is the first step, which is a little bit political, but it's, you know, within the political economy of knowledge, but it's also about the capacity to organize, coordinate, exert collective action, and, well, literally bring people together to create this space, right?
Yeah. Well, the other thought that I have is that there's an important part to play in terms of, you know, which type of knowledge gets greater emphasis. Is it going to be theoretical or is it going to be practical? The public scholarship arena lends itself for much more practical approaches because the bar to entry is a little bit lower in a way. Also, it can extend the network a little bit beyond scholarship. Well, this is also where some other methods, like I'm thinking about action learning or action research, can help with, you know, be able to do, you know, perform research projects that are local, that get at solving practical problems, that can share knowledge that perhaps is a little bit less perceived to be less esoteric and a little bit more, yeah, we get something out of this that we, by participating, that sort of could build a little bit more of a groundswell for support. Whereas if it's all focused at the top end, at the theoretical level, then, you know, in a way it's like, you know, it's competing on their terms and not your own.
No, I think what you're saying, Tom, is very interesting. Like this balance between theoretical and practical. And I think an additional limitation to the kind of research that we can do under this, you know, let's call it the project of a Latin American organization studies, is the diversity and the complexity of the issues that you can study in our country. So, I mean, for example, I'm doing research on a public organization in Mexico. And I remember when I was trying to choose which organization I wanted to approach in order to do an ethnography, there was a limit to how local I could go, because then I would lose the potential to have interesting findings that people from other countries might relate to, right? So I couldn't go, I had to stay at the federal level and I had to stay in Mexico City, because if I went to, I don't know, like a little town in a different state, then I would be studying fascinating phenomena, but that is so local that it would be hard to kind of argue or justify why I went there to study that, right? So there is always, I mean, I don't know what if Leonardo as well, I don't know if you've done research on Brazilian phenomena, but there's always this kind of burden or this thing that like you have to justify why you are studying an organization that is not in the Western world. And it has to be convincing, right? So even in my proposal defense, I remember being kind of told to highlight that some of the phenomena that I'm observing between, you know, how populism is affecting the work of public servants, that, you know, people in the UK or in the US can relate to that as well. So then it's okay for me to study in a Mexican organization. So I think that's another limitation.
Yes, I cannot agree more with you, because one thing that I think it's very important what the tests bring to us, the idea that we can have an eye on this historical perspective on Latin America and all the difference. We cannot import theories without a critical view, and there is no best way and so on, best way to organize, let's say this way, and so on. But on the other hand, I think that maybe what this theories that he are criticized, especially the modernization theories, shows us where we stand in comparison with other countries. I think this is important. Like Samantha said, I don't know if I show a data about Brazil and what this can bring to us to understand some kind of phenomena without some kind of comparison. But on the other hand, it's important that this comparison keep an eye on contextual settings that we are looking. But I kind of sense that maybe it's important to keep the things like universal, so to achieve a broader comprehension of this of this phenomenon. And especially, and you have to say, in the context of Latin America, we have a lot to do inside our continent, because we are saying Latin America, but we can say that Brazil is something, and in other countries is another, especially in South America. And we have our challenge here too, to a broader connection, because universities in Latin America don't talk to each other a lot. And this is the physical, it's near, but it's far away. It's a strange situation, because Brazil speaks Portuguese, but most of the country speaks Spanish, and there is not a mutual understanding. So maybe this is the first challenge. And this is a challenge that the way modernization theory says back in the 50s that, oh, Latin America faced the same problem. So we have to think about the integration of these countries and how we can enter the competitive arena together. So all the idea of the economic blocks and so on comes from this. And it's a project that is not finished. And I think it's maybe it's first the first problem is that, and then we think how we can face the world. But it's this. I think it's important to keep local, but comparability it's important too, to see how this stands in comparison to other countries.
So we talked about the first problem being organizational, right? And it seems the second, not problem, but set of problems are epistemic. Right, in terms of what you, Sam, and Leonardo are talking about, what can study, how do what we study then is perceived, how we frame that in a certain way, what kind of comparisons we do. And I think that one, the very notion of organization helps, right? And that's what we talked about, how it's a double-edged sword, because it does import a particular set of ideas, but at the same time, it enables us to go to fly a little bit higher. And I was thinking, this is not too far from what anthropologists have done with culture, right? Yes, there is variation, but since they are not studying the villages, but in the villages, as Gertz, you know, once famously said, then all the kind of cultural processes, mechanisms, ways of being, and, you know, the way culture, the way you're socialized, the way there can be a clash of ideas, the way in which the foreigners perceived, the way in which, you know, certain categories are not universal, like time and space, you name it. The whole anthropology, and to such extent, even sociology and social science at large, they have learned from very esoteric social, you know, air quotes here, places. And that have become, you know, analytical tools that we use in all kinds of contexts, right? And culture, I think, is interesting because it's exactly something that came from very remote type of situation and is now used for business corporations all around the world. So I think the concept of organization can help us here already as well. But there is the problem that even if you analytically can make this effort, this exercise, it is a matter of how knowledge is perceived. Because as we know, to be part of colonial heritage means exactly what you're saying, that whatever that you do is perceived in a more exotic lens, right? That is something that is unique to that. Because it's the burden of that condition. You are marked as something else than the norm. And that's where I think the whole epistemological affirmation that Ibarra Collado is proposing becomes relevant, because it becomes a challenge of trying to build on that and try to see from that, once we deal with the political economy of knowledge and saying, look, this is how it happens, and you are only looking at me and are looking at these texts or ideas or findings in such a way because you're accustomed to have these exotic tinted glasses in which you perceive what is order to you. The very notion that there is an order to you has been constructed. The first challenge is actually to try to dissolve a little bit of that, right? You know, there are all kinds of rhetorics and ways in which this can be done. Because I think that's important to also say here that sameness and difference is rhetorical, analytical, political way, right? Why things that happen in New York are more universal than things that happen, I don't know, in Detroit, right? So these are is a problem also for other contexts, and we can learn from that as well. So I think there is something about trying, and again, that's what I think is important, a text like the one of Ibarra Collado, because it's the shoulder on which we can stand. to try to justify and try to deconstruct and claim space for the research that we believe is important, right? And people like you, Sam, are doing.
Yeah, and I think to go back to the organizational side of scholarship as well, there's a very important question to ask ourselves is, what is the appropriate way to determine the validity of the research being done? So if we're talking about a local project, and the focus really does have to be local, because each nation within Latin America is a different context potentially. And there is certainly a lot of there's a lot that will probably that would probably be researched that is only going to have realistically very local importance, but the broader knowledge is still worth sharing. And right now, the system, the peer review system, for whatever reason that we want to say, is kind of designed to say no, as opposed to being designed to say yes. And so then in a lot of ways, I think, this is where public scholarship, a more public scholarship type of a model becomes helpful, is because public scholarship at least is geared towards saying yes and to making things releasable. That way, there's opportunities for the emergence of those who could become effective reviewers or whatever the equivalent is. So, the key is that there's got to be an orientation, there definitely has to be a local orientation to figure out how to get to yes very efficiently so that we don't in the creation of this other organization or this other construct that is going to foster research, don't unintentionally import the same barriers that we're trying to stand astride, because this is also really important when we start talking about language. Taking Ibarra Colada to the fullest extreme, he wasn't just talking about Spanish and Portuguese. He was talking about so many other languages. On the one hand, there would be so much richness in being able to pursue an agenda that allows for the inclusion of all of those voices. On the other hand, there is the challenge of how then do you validate or do you encourage that there's real research being done and that there's something valuable and a contribution to knowledge being made without going, to use an American metaphor, wild, wild west. I mean, to go with just letting everything out and then you present an unintentional view that what's being done here is watered down.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why a lot of the kind of natural house for or natural home for all of this that we're discussing seems to be critical management studies, right? Because it's where you kind of feel more freedom to be able to have, different types of methods, different types of findings, even different types of objects of study. Because I think especially what you were mentioning, Tom, about how do we keep, this kind of openness and diversity from going kind of too wild or too crazy. And I think the most important question is what kind of criteria can we use to determine what is useful and important research and what isn't?
So I agree with what you said, but I see it in a different way because I was looking at this more longitudinally, right? I think that is the main difference from when Ibarra Colada was writing and the world we are now, because I feel that the political economy has changed in a way that, not just in science, right, but in many things, the condition of post-coloniality has shifted and has been normalized a bit more because the hegemony of power has changed. China is a clear example. And with that change has come all kinds of ideas about what is from culture to knowledge in itself. Think about, Parasite winning the Oscar for best movie. So to think about the arts, think about the way in part the economic gravity center has been pulverized more and more, right? With China and other countries emerging. So I think there is in a way a sense of destabilization and enlargement of what is the neutral, the center, with all these different shifts that have occurred that have created more space to what would once be as seen as completely different and marked to be accepted, to gain more traction in the mainstream, so to speak. And I agree that certainly CMS was the natural incubator for that. But I think that we are in a phase in which this has poked through more and more. So the Academy of Management is talking about internationalizing or global organizational theory. They have an award for that. They have a PDW for that. There is, if anything, an appetite from what I hear editors about this kind of thing, you know, which I think, again, is connected to the world we live in today. And maybe this is just part of a different way in which coloniality is repackaged, right? You cannot just keep them silent, so we have to include them in the conversation in particular ways. And that's what we have always seen in all social movements, right? From the queer movement to the feminist to racist, like there is a push, and in time people get invited to the boardroom, but they cannot speak, but then they get to speak, and there is tension. So there's always this continuous accommodation. So I think since this text was published, there has been more space. And if anything, I think the challenge, as Samantha was saying, is trying to find the rhetoric and the way in which we can package and showcase the relevance and connection that exists and potential of this, which would all once be considered not just different, but unique. I think there's more space to create, to claim that it's different, but given the world we're living in, given a whole set of things, there's still much to be learned from that. And I think that in a way, the context is propitious for that. But maybe I'm being just too optimistic.
Yeah, just to add, Pedro, because I think it's important this, because maybe when the authors, then the idea of neoliberalism that the author was fighting against, the idea that we have one best way, it's a kind of one best way to organize. Maybe now we can say this about technology, because we are living in a era maybe of that everybody say that, oh, this is a new era of technologies that will change the landscape of organizations forever in a homogeneous way. All the organizations have to adopt this kind of technologies, and especially digital technologies. And so we see this, like there were many reports and government plans saying that we are preparing ourselves to the fourth industrial revolution, and all organizations will have to adapt to this way. And maybe we see a lot of studies of how organizations adapt in the different way technologies, and that this is not something that's so equal in all organizations. And maybe the way this text brings us to us this idea, the importance to keep to see how different contexts. You see that how an organization in Brazil will adopt some kind of technologies. We actually have a lot of studies like this, how organizations in countryside of Brazil, I think in Latin America as well, are using technologies in a certain way to adapt to their routines. But it's something that we can see, like the studies of, I don't know, Wanda Rakowski, that say how organizations and how agents adapt technologies in their daily life. It's more an idea that, oh, this is something that Latin America has to do to be a part of the world of the production of science. But on the other way, is something that I think it's important to keep in our research here in Latin America, to see how organizations here are adapting some trends of the world, because we are not, how would I say, we are affected by this, but maybe not in the way that the center think will be that optimist. But you know, I think we have to keep an eye on this, that maybe here it's kind of different, and this difference maybe show us how we can improve the organizations around here.
So let's try to use this as a platform to think together what this research would look like, right? Especially because I know that Sam has done, you know, multiple research projects in Latin America. So there is something about this comparative dimension for sure. And a quick plug here, you're talking about technology, and I think there is an upcoming piece by Jerry Davis on the Organizational Theory Journal, which is an open science publication that's about varieties of uberization, looking exactly how something that seems to be very global and almost like homogeneous as an idea as Uber or any kind of similar competitors has taken very different forms given the technological and regulatory environment in different countries. You know, so there's something about trying to look at variation, right? So if one would go and do a study about bureaucracy in terms of public administration across the world and would look at the particular ways in which Latin America versus Asia versus Africa versus Europe has contended with, I don't know, delivering services to citizens and or organizing different ministries and the way in which the career of, you know, public officials is structured and what consequences are there. And people study that, of course, right? There is comparative sociological study that has done that. That is one layer. So we can think maybe what are other avenues of concrete research programs we can think that learn from what Ibarra Collado said and look forward in light of what we're experiencing today.
Again, I'm really thinking about the big questions one step at a time, because things the pandemic offers us a chance to take another look at some of the things that institutions that we've relied on very heavily for keeping a populace safe and in order to in terms of response and all that sort of thing. Taking a good critical look at a local level of just how do government goods or services, largely government services, meet the needs of the people? And that's sort of like an agenda question unto itself. And it's not the way that we typically frame questions as scholars. But that would be a logical first step for me, because I would think that would be something that would be easy. It would be good to compare different models of service providing and try to come up with different, context-dependent ways of understanding how we measure performance and success. Because in a lot of ways, I think that's one area where models coming in from the outside can definitely cause us to mix apples and oranges and come up with a very murky fruit salad. Because what constitutes a legitimate service, even in the next town over, or the next city over, or province, much less a whole different country entirely, we just won't be talking the same language. But it's something that I think everybody can grasp onto. It's very tangible. I mean, even if it is an intangible type of a service, it's a tangible idea that we understand, what we would be wanting to do overall is to change our measure of trust in the ability for societies and governments and whatever to all cooperate together to solve big problems. And I kind of bring that up because that's an underlying tone in a lot of what Ibarra Collado was complaining about. It wasn't just the state of the scholarship, but also the notion that there's a lot of social problems that are not being attended to. That would it would not only seem like a straightforward first step, it is also one that I think would make a lot of sense, would generate a little bit more interest in terms of what would be explored, what people would want to know about. And the challenge, I think, is going to be to do so without putting anybody on the defensive, because naturally, one of the things you always get concerned about when we're talking about government services is putting civil servants on the defensive, which would just kill the whole idea. I hope that makes sense.
It does, and I think it opens the different dimensions of, I think, future research, which is comparative, as we said before, but also being aware of differences and the possibility in which there are different solutions for the same problems. So this kind of, there's a concept for that people use.
Well, as a human and organization learning guy, my initial thought is to go to The Evolutionary Motor of Change by Van de Ven and Poole. But I'm sure that's not related to what you're talking about.
It's this like the structural equivalence. There is this idea of a structural equivalence, right? That there are other possible solutions for the same kind of similar kind of problems. And people like Erin McDonald, to say one, has this very interesting research in which she goes and looks at state bureaucracy across different places. And I think she's studying in particular Ghana, right?
Are you talking about equifinality?
Yes! Equifinality. Thank you. And she shows that there are different ways through which one can build an effective bureaucracy that, reflects the value of impartiality and all this kind of stuff, right, that are typical of bureaucratic administration through different tools. And that is not only about, you know, how much procedures and number of rules you have, but it's about cultivating a particular set of ethos within the corpse of the public administration. And there are different tools for which you can cultivate that. And she has this interesting argument, exactly, that it's comparative, but also trying to expand the theory and expand what are the mechanisms that we know and realize there are different ones that can be used to achieve that. So there is this, you know, I think this is another side of this comparative. It's comparative with the sensibility, so to speak.
That actually spurred another thought that I had, because I've talked a lot about government. But if there is something else that perhaps gets downplayed in other contexts, but might seem to be a very, very important facet, and I'm not sure how this would fit, but religion in terms, and I'm not talking about just the, you know, the major religions, but also the indigenous religions, which also can speak to a lot of different models of organizing very, very locally context-dependent solutions that could very well be salient. And, you know, and how that would be incorporated in a way that that's pluralistic. When you basically have a similar problem where local contexts are different and religion plays a big part in how people define themselves, then it does become an interesting problem of trying to determine what is a broad range solution that incorporates what are some really, really deeply held values that may be contradictory. And of course, identity can definitely be a double-edged sword in that regard, because we may be talking about things where we have to get people together who are otherwise historic adversaries, shall we say. Not just addressing the problem, but also trying to think about how to bridge gaps as a research agenda would also seem to be important, because it's not about, like, one way to bridge gaps is to just eliminate them by everything coming down from above, shall we say. But an alternative is to try to bridge them from across, from the bottom.
Yeah, no, I think religion is definitely an interesting one. And more, I don't know, I was thinking how relevant it would be in some of the settings that I've done studies on. And I think maybe we amplify it a little bit more, not so much religion, but values and ideologies. I think that's something that definitely is important.
So can I have a stab at that? Because we are all talking, and I was like doing a mental index of the ways, and I think if I were to do an appendix, right, to the paper, what would be the concrete research problems with, like, researchable questions? We talked about the comparative dimension. I think that is a classic, and I think this exists a lot, right? And I think that is usually what people think about when talk about research of that nature, right? And to go back to what Sam was saying, it's also an easier path, because you can make the argument that you're looking at the same problem, phenomena, whatever, in a different context, and that, you know, is going to give you an edge, you know, to have give you more analytical traction. But I think there are at least other three ways which can be relevant. And we can take the case of religion or values or ideology. And one, I think, has to do with studying, and Ibarra Collado touched on that, the genealogy, right? To see how was it before Latin America became Catholic or became, you know, under these auspices of the UN and idea of modernization that Leonardo was talking about, or you name it, right? So what existed that was indigenous, and all those voices that have been silenced and are continuously silenced, and not only Latin America, but also in places like Australia, the US as well, and, you know, all other type of, but even also in Europe, if you go, you know, I'm even in Denmark now, and there's a lot of discussions regarding Greenland and what kind of, you know, colonial past there is there. So, you know, all to say that there is something about, if a person were to do a research, I think, in light of Ibarra Collado suggesting, I think one clear direction would be to look at the genealogy of how certain ideas have taken root. We can go back to the goals of the hospital. Why do we have the hospital in a particular way? What was there before? What existed? What maybe still exists in the interstices, right? That doesn't get much of airtime, but exists in a precarious way. The other way, I think, is related, but it's about the connection. So again, how did we come to have this idea of the hospital there? How did we come to have the idea that bureaucracy is universal and everyone is supposed to have an impartial public service and there is one way to achieve that? I think we can agree that there's an important element, but as someone like Aaron has showed, it's not just how many procedures you have. And it's important because for a long time, the World Bank, the UN, and all these like supranational institutions have created all these kind of measures and indexes of, you know, corruption and bureaucracy quality. And they're usually based on particular measurements that are corresponding to a particular version of bureaucratic administration, be it based on a lot of procedures that we have, you know, we know that's not necessarily the only mechanism, right? Because there is equifinality. So there is something about the connections and how the world has come to be what it is and what has been exported as the template and how that has wiped or complicated and has prevented the recognition of alternatives that exist. And I think Ibarra Collado is hitting at that, right? Because if you only think with one model, then everything's necessarily or tends to be seen as lacking. And the third one, I think, is about this exactly what Tom's original point was what is the different kind of conditions that exist, right? And the case of religions is one that's very blatant. And there is a lot of research, I think, nowadays on Islamic finance and other things, right, to show case that, you know, the way you run a bank, for example, may be in a certain way in Tokyo or London, but it's certainly different if you go to the Arabic world, in certain places, for example, in Pakistan, right? Or the way in which political organizations, political parties are organized is going to be one in Denmark, but it's certainly very different if you are in the US even, and we know that religion is certainly a part of the political debate in the US, but also Brazil, right? There is a strong presence of religious values and I think the interesting thing is that if one has an analytical sensitivity, one can think of connections across many different places. We have the unfortunate case of the beheading of the teacher in France, right? And this has reemerged the debate, what is the role of religion in schools and so on and so forth. So in a way, if one picks through the surface, one can start to see that some of the conditions may exist in different levels, different formations, in different places. So there are something to be gained if one were to study, I don't know, religion or bank in Colombia versus a political party in Mexico. I think there's a third leg. So just to recap, comparative work, genealogies, tracing connections, and understanding the particular conditions that have emerged under a particular phenomenon.
Yeah, I think in one of those legs, I think we can add the idea of the study of state-owned enterprises is something that's very important. I think the author has a beautiful sentence about a phrase about this, because he said that this state-owned enterprise are closer to the ghost of Machiavelli than to the ghost of Weber's Protestant ethical. It's important, I think, to look more closer to state-owned enterprise and see how the role of government and shape the landscape of organizations in Latin America. It's very important because the role of state to the development and to the economic growth of these countries, it's very important. So the state is the great ruler of how companies react to the actions of the state. So it's important to put this. And maybe one of the few studies that I remember that do this is Limits of Convergence. Who wrote that book was Mauro Gillen. It's an important study that compares how Argentina state and South Korea state bring efforts together to evolve, but looking into the companies. So maybe this is something that the text brought this test brought to me something that we talk about modernization, we talk about development, but we don't talk a lot about how companies react to this public policies of the state, how companies react to the promote the state fostering the investments and trying to develop the society and the economy. So maybe this is a thing that is important to look in a comparable way. So how in Mexico was companies react in different sectors. So maybe this is a kind of research agenda that I think it's lacking in Latin America. It's important to not think so much in big trends and see how companies really react, how organizations really react to state policies.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I would also add another item to your list, Pedro, of having this sensitivity to the layers that exist in Latin American organizations. And I'm referring here to like this history of incomplete reforms that most organizations, and I mean particularly in the public sector, have been through. So being aware of, you know, when you're starting an organization, of all the projects that have existed, of how to shape and structure that organization, and how, because these projects tend to be imported from you know, the Anglo-Saxon theories, as Ivar Colello calls them, how they've kind of met with resistance, and some of the features of these reforms have stayed, some of them have never really stuck. And then on top of that, you know, 10 years after that, you have another kind of layer of reforms. And so at the end, you have to be very aware that what you're studying is really the result of what was there and all the kind of resistance to these different reforms, and then some elements that did actually stick.
We wish to thank our special guest, Samantha Ortiz, for joining us in this episode. And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Audner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberto Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Vili Ledon-Virta, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.